to BB. Once more, let us inquire, if the one is not, and the others of the one are, what follows? In the first place, the others will not be the one, nor the many, for in that case the one would be contained in them. Neither will they appear to be one or many, because they have no communion or participation in that which is not, nor semblance of that which is not. If one is not, the others neither are, nor appear to be one or many, like or unlike, in contact or separation. In short, if one is not, nothing is. The result of all which is, that whether one is or is not, one and the others, in relation to themselves, and to one another, are and are not, and appear to be, and appear not to be, in all manner of ways. 1. On the first hypothesis we may remark, first, that one is an identical proposition, from which we might expect that no further consequences could be deduced. The train of consequences which follows, is inferred by altering the predicate into not many. Yet, perhaps, if a stricturistic had been present, he might have affirmed, that the not many presented a different aspect of the conception from the one, and was therefore not identical with it. Such a subtlety would be very much in character with the Zenonian dialectic. Secondly, we may note, that the conclusion is really involved in the premises. For one is conceived as one, in a sense which excludes all predicates. When the meaning of one has been reduced to a point, there is no use in saying, that it has neither parts nor magnitude. Thirdly, the conception of the same is, first of all, identified with the one, and then by further analysis distinguished from, and even opposed to it. Fourthly, we may detect notions, which have reappeared in modern philosophy, e.g. the bare abstraction of undefined unity, answering to the Hegelian saying, or the identity of contradictions, that which is older is also younger, etc., or the Kantian conception of an a priori synthetical proposition one is. 2. In the first series of propositions the word is really the copula, in the second, the verb of existence. As in the first series, the negative consequence followed from one, being affirmed to be equivalent to the not many, so here the affirmative consequences deduced from one, being equivalent to the many. In the former case, nothing could be predicated of the one, but now everything, multitude, relation, place, time, transition. One is regarded in all the aspects of one, and with a reference to all the consequences which flow, either from the combination or the separation of them. The notion of transition involves the singular extratemporal conception of suddenness. This idea of suddenness is based upon the contradiction which is involved in supposing that anything can be in two places at once. It is a mere fiction, and we may observe that similar antinomies have led modern philosophers to deny the reality of time and space. It is not the infinitesimal of time, but the negative of time. By the help of this invention, the conception of change, which sorely exercised the minds of early thinkers, seems to be, but is not truly at all explained. The difficulty arises out of the imperfection of language, and should therefore be no longer regarded as a difficulty at all. The only way of meeting it, if it exists, is to acknowledge that this rather puzzling double conception is necessary to the expression of the phenomena of motion or change, and that this and similar double notions, instead of being anomalies, are among the higher and more potent instruments of human thought. The processes by which Parmenides obtains his remarkable results may be summed up as follows. 1. Compound or correlative ideas which involve each other, such as, being and not being, one and many, are conceived sometimes in a state of composition, and sometimes of division. 2. The division or distinction is sometimes heightened into total opposition, e.g. between one and same, one and other, or, 3. The idea, which has been already divided, is regarded, like a number, as capable of further infinite subdivision. 4. The argument often precedes a dicto secundum quid ad dictum simpliciter and conversely. 5. The analogy of opposites is misused by him. He argues indiscriminately sometimes from what is like, sometimes from what is unlike in them. 6. The idea of being or not being is identified with existence or non-existence in place or time. 7. The same ideas are regarded sometimes as in process of transition, sometimes as alternatives or opposites. 8. There are no degrees or kinds of sameness, likeness, difference, nor any adequate conception of motion or change. 9. 1. Being, time, like space in Zeno's puzzle of Achilles and the tortoise, are regarded sometimes as continuous and sometimes as discrete. 10. In some parts of the argument, the abstraction is so rarefied as to become not only fallacious, but almost unintelligible, e.g. in the contradiction which is elicited out of the relative terms older and younger at p. 152. 11. The relation between two terms is regarded under contradictory aspects, as for example when the existence of the one and the non-existence of the one are equally assumed to involve the existence of the many. 12. Words are used through long chains of argument, sometimes loosely, sometimes with the precision of numbers, or of geometrical figures. The argument is a very curious piece of work, unique in literature. It seems to be an exposition, or rather a reductio ad absurdum of the Megarian philosophy, but we are too imperfectly acquainted with this last to speak with confidence about it. It would be safer to say that it is an indication of the skeptical, hyperlogical fancies which prevailed among the contemporaries of Socrates. It throws an indistinct light upon Aristotle, and makes us aware of the debt which the world owes to him, or his school. It also bears a resemblance to some modern speculations, in which an attempt is made to narrow language in such a manner that number and figure may be made a calculus of thought. It exaggerates one side of logic, and forgets the rest. It has the appearance of a mathematical process. The inventor of it delights, as mathematicians do, in eliciting or discovering an unexpected result. It also helps to guard us against some fallacies by showing the consequences which flow from them. In the Parmenides we seem to breathe the spirit of the Megarian philosophy, though we cannot compare the two in detail. But Plato also goes beyond his Megarian contemporaries. He has split their straws over again and admitted more than they would have desired. He is indulging the analytical tendencies of his age, which can divide but not combine. And he does not stop to inquire whether the distinctions which he makes are shadowy and fallacious, but whether the argument blows he follows. 3. The negative series of propositions contains the first conception of the negation of a negation. 2 minus signs in arithmetic or algebra make a plus. 2 negatives destroy each other. This abstruse notion is the foundation of the Hegelian logic. The mind must not only admit that determination is negation, but must get through negation into affirmation. Whether this process is real, or in any way an assistance to thought, or, like some other logical forms, a mere figure of speech transferred from the sphere of mathematics, may be doubted. That Plato and the most subtle philosopher of the 19th century should have lighted upon the same notion is a singular coincidence of ancient and modern thought. 4. The one and the many or others are reduced to their strictest arithmetical meaning. That one is three or three one is a proposition which has, perhaps, given rise to more controversy in the world than any other. But no one has ever meant to say that three and one are to be taken in the same sense. Whereas the one and many of the Parmenides have precisely the same meaning, there is no notion of one personality or substance having many attributes or qualities. The truth seems to be rather the opposite of that which Socrates implies at page 129. There is no contradiction in the concrete, but in the abstract, and the more abstract the idea, the more palpable will be the contradiction. For just as nothing can persuade us that the number one is the number three, so neither can we be persuaded that any abstract idea is identical with its opposite, although they may both inhere together in some external object, or some more comprehensive conception. Ideas, persons, things may be one in one sense and many in another, and may have various degrees of unity and plurality. But in whatever sense, and in whatever degree they are one, they cease to be many. and in whatever degree or sense they are many, they cease to be one. 2 points remain to be considered. First, the connection between the first and second parts of the dialogue. Tunlai, the relation of the Parmenides to the other dialogues. 1. In both divisions of the dialogue, the principal speaker is the same, and the method pursued by him is also the same, being a criticism on received opinions. First, on the doctrine of ideas. Secondly, of being. From the Platonic ideas we naturally proceed to the eleatic one, or being, which is the foundation of them. They are the same philosophy in two forms, and the simpler form is the truer and deeper. For the Platonic ideas are mere numerical differences, and the moment we attempt to distinguish between them, their transcendental character is lost. Ideas of justice, temperance, and good are really distinguishable only with reference to their application in the world. If we once ask how they are related to individuals, or to the ideas of the divine mind, they are again merged in the aboriginal notion of being. No one can answer the questions which Parmenides asks of Socrates. And yet these questions are asked with the express acknowledgement that the denial of ideas will be the destruction of the human mind. The true answer to the difficulty here thrown out is the establishment of a rational psychology, and this is a work which is commenced in the Sophist. Plato, in urging the difficulty of his own doctrine of ideas, is far from denying that some doctrine of ideas is necessary, and for this, he is paving the way. In a similar spirit, he criticizes the eleatic doctrine of being, not intending to deny ontology, but showing that the old eleatic notion, and the very name being, is unable to maintain itself against the subtleties of the Megarians. He did not mean to say that being, or substance, had no existence, but he is preparing for the development of his later view, that ideas were capable of relation. The fact that contradictory consequences follow from the existence or non-existence of one or many, does not prove that they have or have not existence, but rather that some different mode of conceiving them is required. Parmenides may still have thought that being was, just as Kant would have asserted the existence of things in themselves, while denying the transcendental use of the categories. Several lesser links also connect the first and second parts of the dialogue. 1. The thesis is the same as that which Zeno has been already discussing. 2. Parmenides has intimated in the first part that the method of Zeno should, as Socrates desired, be extended to ideas. 3. The difficulty of participating in greatness, smallness, equality is urged against the ideas as well as against the one. 2. The Parmenides is not only a criticism of the eleatic notion of being, but also of the methods of reasoning then in existence, and in this point of view, as well as in the other, may be regarded as an introduction to the Sophist. Long ago, in the Euthydemus, the vulgar application of the both and neither heuristic had been subjected to a similar criticism, which there takes the form of banter and the irony, here of illustration. The attack upon the ideas is resumed in the Philebus, and is followed by return to a more rational philosophy. The perplexity of the one and many is there confined to the region of ideas, and replaced by a theory of classification. The good arranged in classes is also contrasted with the barren abstraction of the Megarians. The war is carried on against the heuristics in all the later dialogues, sometimes with a playful irony, at other times with a sort of contempt. But there is no length and refutation of them. The Parmenides belongs to that stage of the dialogues of Plato in which he is partially under their influence, using them as a sort of critics, or diviners of the truth of his own, and of the eleatic theories. In the Theaetetus, a similar negative dialectic is employed in the attempt to define science, which after every effort remains undefined still. The same question is revived from the objective side in the Sophist. Being and not being are no longer exhibited in opposition, but are now reconciled, and the true nature of not being is discovered and made the basis of the correlation of ideas. Some links are probably missing which might have been supplied if we had trustworthy accounts of Plato's oral teaching. To sum up, the Parmenides of Plato is a critique, first, of the Platonic ideas, and secondly, of the elite doctrine of being. Neither are absolutely denied, but certain difficulties and consequences are shown in the assumption of either, which prove that the Platonic as well as the elite doctrine must be remodeled. The negation and contradiction which are involved in the conception of the One, and many are preliminary to their final adjustment. The Platonic ideas are tested by the interrogative method of Socrates. The elite One, or being, is tried by the severer, and perhaps impossible method of hypothetical consequences, negative and affirmative. In the latter we have an example of the Zenonian or Megarian dialectic, which proceeded, not by assailing premises, but conclusions. This is worked out and improved by Plato. When primary abstractions are used in every conceivable sense, any or every conclusion may be deduced from them. The words one, other, being, like, same, whole, and their opposites, have slightly different meanings, as they are applied to objects of thought or objects of sense, to number, time, place, and to the higher ideas of the reason, and out of their different meanings this feast of contradictions has been provided. The Parmenides of Plato belongs to a stage of philosophy which has passed away. At first we read it with a purely antiquarian or historical interest, and with difficulty, throw ourselves back into a state of the human mind in which unity and being occupied the attention of philosophers. We admire the precision of the language, in which, as in some curious puzzle, each word is exactly fitted into every other, and long trains of argument are carried out with a sort of geometrical accuracy. We doubt whether any abstract notion could stand the searching cross-examination of Parmenides, and may at last perhaps arrive at the conclusion that Plato has been using an imaginary method to work out an unmeaning conclusion. But the truth is that he is carrying on a process which is not either useless or unnecessary in any age of philosophy. We fail to understand him because we do not realize that the questions which he is discussing could have had any value or importance. We suppose them to be like the speculations of some of the schoolmen, which end in nothing. But in truth he is trying to get rid of the stumbling blocks of thought which beset his contemporaries. Seeing that the Megarians and Cynics were making knowledge impossible, he takes their catchwords and analyzes them from every conceivable point of view. He is criticizing the simplest and most general of our ideas, in which, as they are most comprehensive, the danger of error is the most serious. For, if they remain unexamined, as in a mathematical demonstration, all that flows from them is affected, and the error pervades knowledge far and wide. In the beginning of philosophy this correction of human ideas was even more necessary than in our own times, because they were more bound up with words, and words, when once presented to the mind, exercised a greater power over thought. There is a natural realism which says, can there be a word devoid of meaning, or an idea which is an idea of nothing? In modern times mankind have often given too great importance to a word or idea. The philosophy of the ancients was still more in slavery to them, because they had not the experience of error, which would have placed them above the illusion. The method of the Parmenides may be compared with the process of purgation, which Bacon sought to introduce into philosophy. Plato is warning us against two sorts of idols of the din. First, his own ideas, which he himself having created is unable to connect in any way with the external world. Secondly, against two idols in particular, unity and being, which had grown up in the pre-Socratic philosophy, and were still standing in the way of all progress and development of thought. He does not say with Bacon, let us make truth by experiment, or from these vague and inexact notions let us turn to facts. The time has not yet arrived for a purely inductive philosophy. The instruments of thought must first be forged, that they may be used hereafter by modern inquirers. How, while mankind were disputing about universals, could they classify phenomena? How could they investigate causes, when they had not as yet learned to distinguish between a cause and an end? How could they make any progress in the sciences without first arranging them? These are the deficiencies which Plato is seeking to supply in an age when knowledge was a shadow of a name only. In the earlier dialogues, the Socratic conception of universals is illustrated by his genius. In the Phaedrus, the nature of division is explained. In the Republic, the law of contradiction and the unity of knowledge are asserted. In the later dialogues, he is constantly engaged both with the theory and practice of classification. These were the new weapons, as he terms them in the Philebus, which he was preparing for the use of some who, in after ages, would be found ready enough to disown their obligations to the great master, or other, perhaps, would be incapable of understanding them. Numberless fallacies, as we are often truly told, have originated in a confusion of the copula and the verb of existence. Would not the distinction which Plato by the mouth of Parmenides makes between one is one and one has being have saved us from this and many similar confusions? We see again that a long period in the history of philosophy was a barren tract, not uncultivated, but unfruitful, because there was no inquiry into the relation of language and thought, and the metaphysical imagination was incapable of supplying the missing link between words and things. The famous dispute between nominalists and realists would never have been heard of, if, instead of transferring the Platonic ideas into a crude Latin phraseology, the spirit of Plato had been truly understood and appreciated. Upon the torn substance at least two celebrated theological controversies appear to hinge, which would not have existed, or at least not in their present form, if we had interrogated the word substance, as Plato has the notions of unity and being. These weeds of philosophy have struck their roots deep into the soil, and are always tending to reappear, sometimes in newfangled forms, while similar words, such as development, evolution, law, and the like, are constantly put in the place of facts, even by writers who profess to base truth entirely upon fact. In an unmetaphysical age, there is probably more metaphysics in the common sense, i.e. more a priori assumption, than in any other, because there is more complete unconsciousness, that we are resting on our own ideas, while we please ourselves with the conviction that we are resting on facts. We do not consider how much metaphysics are required to place us above metaphysics, or how difficult it is to prevent the forms of expression which are ready made for our use from outrunning actual observation and experiment. In the last century, the educated world were astonished to find that the whole fabric of their ideas was falling to pieces, because Hume amused himself by analyzing the word cause into uniform sequence. Then arose a philosophy which, equally regardless of the history of the mind, sought to save mankind from skepticism by assigning to our notions of cause and effect, substance and accident, whole and part, a necessary place in human thought. Without them we could have no experience, and therefore they were supposed to be prior to experience, to be incrusted on the eye, although in the phraseology of Kant there could be no transcendental use of them, or, in other words, they were only applicable within the range of our knowledge. But into the origin of these ideas, which he obtains partly by an analysis of the proposition, partly by a development of the ego, he never inquires. They seem to him to have a necessary existence, nor does he attempt to analyze the various senses in which the word cause or substance may be employed. The philosophy of Berkeley could never have had any meaning, even to himself, if he had first analyzed from every point of view the conception of matter. This poor forgotten word, which was a very good word to describe the simplest generalization of external objects, is now superseded in the vocabulary of physical philosophers by force, which seems to be accepted without any rigid examination of its meaning, as if the general idea of force in our minds furnished an explanation of the infinite variety of forces which exist in the universe. A similar ambiguity occurs in the use of the favorite word law, which is sometimes regarded as a mere abstraction, and then elevated into a real power or entity, almost taking the place of God. Theology, again, is full of undefined terms which have distracted the human mind for ages. Mankind have reasoned from them, but not to them. They have drawn out the conclusions without proving the premises. They have asserted the premises without examining the terms. The passions of religious parties have been roused to the utmost about words, of which they could have given no explanation, and which had really no distinct meaning. One sort of them, faith, grace, justification, have been the symbols of one class of disputes, as the words substance, nature, person, of another, revelation, inspiration, and the like, of a third. All of them have been the subject of endless reasonings and inferences, but a spell has hung over the minds of theologians or philosophers which has prevented them from examining the words themselves. Either the effort to rise above and beyond their own first ideas was too great for them, or there might, perhaps, have seemed to be an irreverence in doing so. About the divine being himself, in whom all true theological ideas live and move, men have spoken and reasoned much, and have fancied that they instinctively know him. But they hardly suspect that under the name of God even Christians have included two characters, or natures as much opposed as the good and evil principle of the Persians. To have the true use of words we must compare them with things. In using them, we acknowledge that they seldom give a perfect representation of our meaning. In like manner when we interrogate our ideas we find that we are not using them always in the sense which we supposed. And Plato, while he criticizes the inconsistency of his own doctrine of universals, and draws out the endless consequences which flow from the assertion either that being is or that being is not, by no means intends to deny the existence of universals, or the unity under which they are comprehended. There is nothing further from his thoughts than skepticism. But before proceeding he must examine the foundations which he and others have been laying. There is nothing true which is not from some point of view untrue, nothing absolute which is not also relative. And so, in modern times, because we are called upon to analyze our ideas, and to come to a distinct understanding about the meaning of words, because we know that the powers of language are very unequal to the subtlety of nature or of mind, we do not therefore renounce the use of them, but we replace them in their old connection, having first tested their meaning and quality, and having corrected the error which is involved in them, or rather always remembering, to make allowance for the adulteration or alloy which they contain. We cannot call a new metaphysical world into existence any more than we can frame a universal language. In thought, as in speech, we are dependent on the past. We know that the words cause and effect are very far from representing to us the continuity or the complexity of nature or the different modes or degrees in which phenomena are connected. Yet we accept them as the best expression which we have of the correlation of forces or objects. We see that the term law is a mere abstraction, under which laws of matter and of mind, the law of nature and the law of the land are included, and some of these uses of the word are confusing, because they introduce into one sphere of thought associations which belong to another. For example, order or sequence is apt to be confounded with external compulsion, and the internal workings of the mind with their material antecedents. Yet none of them can be dispensed with. We can only be on our guard against the error or confusion which arises out of them. Thus in the use of the word substance we are far from supposing that there is any mysterious substratum apart from the objects which we see, and we acknowledge that the negative notion is very likely to become a positive one. Still we retain the word as a convenient generalization, though not without a double sense, substance and essence, derived from the twofold translation of the Greek, so the human mind makes the reflection that God is not a person like ourselves, is not a cause like the material causes in nature, nor even an intelligent cause like a human agent, nor an individual, for he is universal, and that every possible conception which we can form of him is limited by the human faculties. We cannot by any effort of thought or exertion of faith be in and out of our own minds at the same instant. How can we conceive him under the forms of time and space, who is out of time and space? How get rid of such forms, and see him as he is? How can we imagine his relation to the world or to ourselves? Innumerable contradictions follow from either of the two alternatives, that God is, or that he is not. Yet we are far from saying that we know nothing of him, because all that we know is subject to the conditions of human thought. To the old belief in him we return, but with corrections. He is a person, but not like ourselves, a mind, but not a human mind, a cause, but not a material cause, nor yet a maker or artificer. The words which we use are imperfect expressions of his true nature, but we do not therefore lose faith in what is best and highest in ourselves and in the world. A little philosophy takes us away from God. A great deal brings us back to him. When we begin to reflect, our first thoughts respecting him and ourselves are apt to be skeptical. For we can analyze our religious as well as our other ideas. We can trace their history. We can criticize their perversion. We see that they are relative to the human mind and to one another. But when we have carried our criticism to the furthest point, they still remain a necessity of our moral nature, better known and understood by us, and less liable to be shaken, because we are more aware of their necessary imperfection. They come to us with better opinion, better confirmation, not merely as the inspirations either of ourselves or of another, but deeply rooted in history and in the human mind.